Thank you very much. First, let me apologize for not making it in for yesterday's talk. Believe me, I would have much more rather have been here than in Chicago. So thank you, and here's today's seminar instead of tomorrow's. I've rearranged my two half talks into what may or may not be a coherent whole. So again, please interrupt if there are problems. But I'll talk about determining the momentum of a photon in a medium, which is a little different than just the momentum of a photon. So in this kind of world year of physics and 100th anniversary of the miracle year, we'll look at the photon and the momentum and a few little problems that we're having. And, you know, again, it's not a big raging controversy, or you would have probably heard about it before this. It has gone on for a long time, however. For about 100 years, people have been debating aspects of this. And so you can tell after 100 years, can't be that important if it's, you know, anyway. So it's not really the grand we, you know, that we all admit that there's a big gaping problem. There are people who will vehemently deny that there is any such problem, as with any controversy. You've got to have those. And then there are people who take sides in it as well, who do say that there is a problem. Second, it's kind of a, you know, ontological, conceptual problem, one of kind of firm beliefs in that, not really so much your engineering practical problem. If it was something that was, again, big enough to be easily seen, you can bet people would have settled this by now. So that means that actually testing any of this is really hard. So when you object to you can't do that, it may actually be true. So the question I want to try and answer or discuss is, what is the momentum of a photon in a medium? So another way of saying it is an experiment to determine the correct energy momentum tensor. And I'll try and use the momentum tensor terminology as little as possible. So this all kind of spurred from a discussion I had at Rochester a few years ago with Lijun Wang after he talked about some of his fast light experiments, and you'll see a little bit of how that comes in later. And Kevin Jones has been a collaborator for a number of years, and we've had a lot of discussions on this, as well as there's input from various other people there at NIST, as well as University of Maryland and Oxford and various other places. So here's our problem. Consider a block of glass on a frictionless surface. So if you heard Peter's talk yesterday, you'll hear a lot of that again today, but I don't know, maybe I'll even give you a different answer. So we have a pulse of light passing through this block of glass, and you're not allowed to worry about reflections or anything like that. We'll say we have a perfect anti-reflection coating on it. What happens to the block of glass? Back to this. We'll get back to the block of glass. Think about it amongst yourself. We'll come back. So to the stress energy tensor, I'll bet you didn't know there was a controversy before maybe yesterday. But again, there's lots of literature on this. So spanning from Minkowski and Einstein and Laub in 1908, I'm going to try and get Einstein into here as many times as I can, even though it's a little gratuitous in some of this. Abraham, 1909, Lowy, Pauli, Penfield and House wrote a book on it. You've probably all read it. Perls in the 70s and Ginsburg both wrote fair number of articles on this. Nelson and Loudon have written some articles in the 90s, and if you look over the past year, there's probably at least another half dozen I could point out. So it's a long-running, if not raging, controversy. What is it? Well, expressions have been proposed for this energy momentum tensor. So the first part here, this is just kind of the history of the problem, and it's not really necessary to the rest of it, but it's kind of fun. So it's arguments about what this energy momentum tensor is in a polarized medium. So it's a question of how you define the momentum and things like that. And splitting the tensor into a field part and a material part leads to much of the controversy. And so the people who claim that there is no controversy are those who say, well, you just did this wrong. If you went back and did it right, there's no problem. And very often this is true. So it's kind of a question of what's the correct form of the field part of the energy momentum tensor. And in fact, the problem is not really well posed unless you talk about both the material and the field part together. So the claim is made that only the sum of the two is physical, but certainly, as far as an experimentalist is concerned, the only thing that we really care about is some physical observable, and you know, the force on an object is one that we can hope to measure. And as I said, it's still kind of a hope to measure it, because the force in this case is a term, it's an average over an oscillating optical field, and that oscillates rather quickly. And so it averages to a pretty small number, hopefully not zero, and maybe we can actually see something of it. So the early work goes back to Lorentz considering forces on a polarized medium, and then we'll get Einstein in again. Einstein and Laub were the first to give a relativistic form for this force density, and they used the same dipole form terms as Lorentz and postulated analogous magnetic terms to go with that. They considered force density in a material at rest and didn't really consider the material part of the thing. Fine. Hermann Minkowski, he comes along and gives a expression for the field energy momentum tensor on the formal grounds that it should be form invariance in all Lorentz frames. So we all hear about these things, and he's arguing that what it ought to, is what ought to determine some of this. This implies the tensor should depend on the fields, but not on the forevelocity of the medium with respect to the observer, and didn't really consider the material part. Max Abraham, a year later, comes up with a different form. He said, well, let's give up this form invariance, but let's assume that the field tensor is symmetric in all Lorentz frames. It contains a field momentum density is proportional to the energy flow and thus obeys the law of inertia of energy. We'll get back to this. Others argue that this should only apply to a closed system and that it's only applicable to the total energy momentum tensor, not just the field tensor. Arguments continue. Von Laue argues in favor of Minkowski's form. The energy transport velocity should transform such the addition rules for four velocities hold. Just say a light wave in a moving body should transform like a particle velocity. So if you could see a little bit of scattering off of the light pulse going through the block of glass, you could track it, and that where that pulse went ought to transform like a particle transformation. Minkowski's form is not the only form of the field tensor that satisfies this. When you add the material part of the tensor, the total tensor doesn't have this property, so you could say, who cares? Beyond that, Abraham's tensor gives a positive energy density for all macroscopic velocities. Consequently, it always gives you a positive photon energy, and Minkowski's, again, you can debate as to whether you're doing it right, but in some ways, using Minkowski's form leads to a negative energy photon, which is a little disturbing. But so the arguments typically only deal with the field portion of the tensor, and the question of how you do this division is always in the back of your mind. You can divide things into a field part and a matter part, but there's often an interaction part that you don't really call a field part or a matter part, and depends on which one you lump it in with as to what your final form looks like. All right, so there's a bit of the wide-ranging history. You will find more forms for the energy tensor through even like last year. There's another one that I've seen. But at any rate, we don't really care about what the tensor looks like. What I want to calculate is the force on this block of glass. And so Minkowski gives a form that looks like this. It's a half E squared del epsilon. And what this says is that I have an electric field for my light pulse coming in, and there's a force that's proportional to the gradient of the dielectric constant of the material. And so there's a surface force where the dielectric constant changes rapidly, and that's what you get for the force on the piece of glass. Abraham comes along with something that's almost that. So the force, according to Abraham, is the Minkowski force plus this extra term here. And this extra term is a little bit weird because E cross H is the Poynting vector. But ddt of that is kind of, this is a rapidly varying thing. So this kind of averages very quickly to small numbers. It's got epsilon mu here, which is essentially the index of refraction squared, divided by c squared. That makes that a small number. And then, well, we'll talk more about this, but there's a bunch of other choices by other authors that I'm not going to tell you about. The main argument ends up falling into the camp of Minkowski versus Abraham. So the Abraham force is what this extra term here is known as. It's generally small, and it's been observed. But under what we would call quasi-static conditions. And so people debate as to whether this applies to propagating fields and optical fields. And again, you can choose your own sides. So, anyway, Abraham force. And then the question, this came from a letter from Einstein, actually, who said to Michel Besseau in 1951, this is the whole 50 years of conscious brooding have not brought me nearer to the answer to the question, what are light quanta? Nowadays, every scalawag believes he knows what they are, but he deceives himself. So, where am I? So, we're going to ask this question, and I'll be the scalawag, and let me mislead you through it. So, consider, again, our block of glass on the frictionless surface. And you send this pulse of light through, what happens to the block of glass? So phrasing this another way is, what is the momentum of the photon when it's in the medium? So looking at this, you have a couple of choices. You can say it doesn't do anything. You can say the photon momentum gets larger. You can say the photon momentum gets smaller. And if you want to cut these any finer than that, I don't want to hear about it, but note that number three is kind of dull, so you don't want to choose that. One and two, these necessarily imply that if you're going to change, if you're going to hold on to the idea that the photon, well, that momentum is conserved, that if you're going to change the momentum of the photon, then the block of glass is going to have to move. And so it's up to you which direction it moves. Well, not completely up to you, but you get to choose for the moment. So you'd think that a simple problem like this would have been answered long ago. Again, in this form of the tensor, stress energy tensor for the system, many, many people have adamantly asserted that they have settled this question, and it continues. So the two main camps are those of Abraham and Minkowski. And since Einstein weighed in on this, we'll give you a little bit of that. But then there is the Toronto connection. Some related experiments, not done with a block of glass, were done here. And so Ephraim encouraged me to include as much Canadian content as possible. So we'll get back to that. So, naive approach number one. In the vacuum, we have lambda is c over nu, and the momentum of the photon, p is h bar k, is h over lambda is h nu over c. Everybody likes that. They better. Everybody agrees on that. In the medium, now, nu stays the same. If you're going to require boundary conditions be satisfied, the frequency of oscillation of the light has to remain constant. But lambda can change, and so lambda is c over the index of refraction in the medium times frequency nu. P is h bar k, which is nh over lambda, which is nh nu over c. Simple enough. All right, so naive approach number two. Let's say momentum is mass times velocity. We all like that. We learned that in our first semester of physics. You'll remember this formula here. You rearrange that a little bit. You got E equal mc squared. So you say the momentum is E over c squared times the velocity c, h nu over c. Everybody's still happy. Do this in the medium. Now, of course, p is mv. V is now c over n because light slows down a little bit going into the medium. P is E over c squared, c over n, h nu over nc. Sounds good, right? Except that there's a little bit of an embarrassing position of that index of refraction between these two seemingly innocuous derivations. So now you get to choose sides, either Mangowski or Abraham. And I won't ask for votes because I think Peter spoiled it yesterday by giving the answer. But well, giving my answer anyway. What was that? All right. Well, so theorists have their own way of approaching these problems. Experimentalists take a slightly different approach. We don't use the sharp sticks. But at any rate, there was a theorist who actually proposed this as a Gedanken experiment. This guy by the name of Balasch, 1953, proposed the following thought experiment. And after some discussion of this, this is kind of what set me onto thinking we could actually do an experiment, was the question of whether you could do this with a kind of metamaterial or something with a negative index of refraction. But we'll come back to that. So the idea is we're going to take a system here of a pulse of light and a block of glass on its frictionless surface, and we're going to send this thing through, and we're going to take an identical system here and send it next to the block of glass rather than through. And it's going to be a completely untouched system, so the center of mass motion of this system should really be the same as the center of mass motion of this. If this one gets displaced by some amount, then this one should get displaced by the same amount. And we should be able to calculate the displacement of the block of glass. I mean, I showed it moving one direction, but the calculation doesn't necessarily choose that. So you can calculate from this how far this block of glass should move and in what direction. So you consider this center of mass motion, and you say, all right, my pulse of light here has some mass. We'll call it E over C squared. But we give this a mass little m. We give our block of glass a bigger mass, big M. Index of refraction n, a length l, some displacement that it moves c. We don't determine the sign, but then we allow this thing to move, and at the point where this pulse just exits the block of glass, we'll take a picture and see where this guy is, and we'll just equate the mass here being moved by the distance, velocity of light times time, ct. And we'll compare that to this little pulse moving a distance x plus c plus l and coming out here, and the big mass moving by distance c. And you do a little bit of math, and you get that as your answer. And it turns out that the displacement of the block is m n minus 1 l over m minus little m n minus 1. So if you look at this and just talk conservation of momentum and say, all right, my pulse here is going to go through and slow down in there and, you know, come out at some distance that's, you know, that basically says that the other pulse of light goes further, So if it slows down in there, then it kind of has to have a smaller momentum in the block, and the block has to move along with it. In fact, this is kind of a circular argument by assuming in the last thing that essentially equal mc squared. I've kind of assumed Abraham's answer in this. But again, in the same sense that I don't necessarily determine the sign of the motion by doing by starting my calculation, I don't actually even determine the sign by ending the calculation. I determine it by doing an experiment. And we'll try to do that. So you can say that in this case, you should think that the photons would have less momentum in the medium than in vacuum. This formula has some kind of interesting bits to it. So again, n minus 1 kind of is the effective mass. This shows up here twice in this. It's kind of the effective mass of the light pulse. And so if you think about this thing plowing through there, what you want is you want to get this thing, of course, as big as possible. But it has some kind of interesting bits. First off, I can only get a good big displacement if I can get mn minus 1 to be comparable to the mass of the block. Now, the mass of a pulse of light is, let's say, notoriously small. So we don't get to play with that a lot. But we can try to play with the index of refraction. So we'll do that. We're going to go for the minimalist block of glass. The absolute smallest block that I can come up with is, for instance, a Bose-Einstein condensate carrying about 1 million atoms. And so that'll be the mass here, the block of glass. If I can get the mass of the light pulse times the index of refraction, so again, I can do things in atomic physics playing with the index of refraction of the material by putting on other light frequencies. So I can do things like electromagnetically induced transparency and make slow light and make a very large index of refraction. So if I can get mn minus 1 to be about what the size of big M is, then I can get very large displacements. Now, infinite might be problematic to some of you. But if you think about what this is really saying is I now take a pulse of light and put it into some block of glass with a really huge index of refraction. And I set the block of glass into motion, and it's moving at about the same velocity as the pulse of light. It can go a long distance. I haven't really assumed that the mass has a velocity in the calculation, so you'd want to be more careful in doing that. But that infinity is not really a problem in this case. Again, I can play with games of doing fast light and slow light in atomic media, and so I can make my index of refraction effectively less than zero. So you can get so-called faster-than-light propagation. And my block of glass should then be able to change direction. So whatever answer you picked, you were right. But you had to also pick an index of refraction. So if you actually go through and calculate from the original expressions that I gave you for what the force on the block of glass is, from Minkowski, you'll get something like this, which says that this displacement is mn minus 1l over m. So in this approximation that I did this calculation, m big M is big M, and I've ignored the correction on the denominator there. So Abraham gives you this, and Minkowski gives you something that looks very similar, but not quite. I mean, it's got this thing times a minus n. So this makes an experimentalist sit up and say, aha, it's a qualitative experiment, and I don't actually have to do this all that carefully because it moves one direction or the other, and I don't have to measure the displacement that carefully. So That makes it look interesting. But this interpretation as given here is really straightforward only if the index is the phase index. So this is explicitly not what I want, since if I'm going to do fast light and slow light type things, it's the group velocity index of refraction that's going to matter. So in that sense, the real experiment that I want to think about won't really answer the Abraham Minkowski question that people have been debating, because everybody ignores dispersion, and I need dispersion. So again, you need a very light block of glass with a very high index of refraction on a completely frictionless surface. And, you know, a Bose condensate is not what most people would have thought of as a block of glass, but under some circumstances, we can get it there. We can give it a huge index, but it's not the phase index. But, you know, again, that's kind of still, we can do a related problem. And we can sit it on a frictionless surface, and in fact, that's easy. We do this all the time with atoms and traps and things like that. So friction is really not a problem, even though that kind of looks a little funny in the beginning. So the proposed experiment, my block of glass here is going to be 3 times 10 to the 6, 3 million sodium atoms in a condensate. That gives me a mass of 1.2 10 to the minus 19 kilograms, and 100 microns is a reasonable size for something like that. My pulse here is going to be, well, a microwatt turns out to be about 3 million photons per microsecond in sodium color. So if you take the mass of this millisecond pulse duration coming in here, you get about 10 to the minus 26 kilograms. That's not very big compared to that. So you can see that if you really wanted to take a piece of glass and put a real piece of glass over here, you'd be in big trouble. But I can play a little bit with the index of refraction. So numbers for the group index of 10 to the 6 are, let's say, reasonable, if not, I mean, they have easily been observed. Maybe not easily. They've been observed. So 10 to the 6 is a not unreasonable number, giving me a transit time of the pulse across this thing of about 0.3 microseconds. If you take this 10 to the 6 index and the little mass up here, that gives me an effective mass here of about 10 to the minus 20 kilograms, which is about a tenth of this, which means that my 100 micron sample will move by about 10 microns. And so this is the realm of possibility. It's encouraging to an experimentalist. Doesn't necessarily mean we can actually do it. All right, so this is the gratuitous. Let's get Einstein in here one more time. Apparently, less than 2 weeks after Minkowski's theory of electrodynamics and moving media appeared, Einstein wrote to his wife, you ever do this, to write to your wife about physics? Great news. On the basis of Jacob Laub's calculations, he had found an error concerning the definition of ponderomotive force density. Together, Einstein and Laub came up with an alternative definition, and he apparently devised some various arguments in defense of this in 1910, lost interest eventually, and in 1918, a letter to Walter Dallenbach, he candidly remarked that it had been known for some time that the expression that he and Laub had derived was false. And, well, you know, things can be said about that. In a completely unrelated but perhaps illuminating comment, Hermann Minkowski said, "The mathematical education of the young physicist Einstein was not very solid, which I'm in a good position to evaluate since he obtained it from me some time ago in Durham." So again, comment not actually made in regard to this, but nonetheless. Einstein and Loeb, tensors not really considered a viable option anymore, but it's still discussed. And so here is a paper from 1979 that came out of the University of Toronto. And they do some measurements, not exactly on a block of glass, but looking at what's essentially the Abraham force. And he says preliminary results favor the Levin's reaction force density and contradict the alternative of Einstein and Laub, which was followed by Abraham and is widely accepted by modern authors. So you can see this is actually a Canadian problem, and there are more. Most of the experiments that claim to be relevant to this, there are a number of people who've done experiments that are relevant but don't discuss this problem. But most of the ones that actually really address this problem were actually done in Canada. So a number of people at Edmonton here. And here's an interesting comment on the previous paper from University of Montreal. Abraham forces discussed briefly. It is recalled the old controversy, as well as efforts to observe the Abraham force, are pointless. It is now well established that both tensors are equally satisfactory as long as these subsystems are treated correctly. If one ascribes to the electromagnetic field a momentum density of E cross H over C squared like Abraham, then Lehaus and Graham has observed magnetic force density on a polarization current. Their interpretation is erroneous. So, controversy continues, and again, he would fall into the category of there is no problem here. Pay attention to doing the calculation correctly. Experiments by Walker, Lehaus and Walker were done in Edmonton. And they did a series of torsion balance experiments. Basically, a disk similar to the experiments that the previous paper that I had up by Graham, and similar also to some work done by James at Stanford in 1968. So what they do is basically there's a dielectric torus basically coated with metallic coatings inside and out on this kind of donut. And you put it in a big, strong magnetic field, and then you put an oscillating electric field across this. So this gives you a time-varying E cross H. It's not really a propagating field. It's not so much what we would want to talk about, a light pulse propagating through a dielectric. But it is a time-varying E cross H, and it's relatively low frequency, 0.4 hertz. They verified the existence of the Abraham force, and at least in this region, I think it's established. But again, people have then continued to debate the question for years afterwards, claiming that this doesn't prove anything about propagating fields. So there's still something for us left to do. Related experiments that, at the time at least, didn't really stress the connection to this, the Jones-Richards and Jones-Leslie experiments, very, very nice set of experiments. Basically, they hang a mirror on a torsion balance and bounce a beam of light off of it and look at the deflection of the mirror. And then you put this whole thing in a bucket and fill it with dielectric. And you look at the change of the deflection with the index of refraction of the dielectric fluid that you pour into the bucket. And you discover that the deflection is proportional to the index of refraction. And it's not exactly what my first reaction would have been, is to say that this is going to be proportional to the index of refraction. And many people have used this as an argument. If you'll remember, Minkowski kind of said P is N H bar K. And so this has been used as an argument in favor of the Minkowski interpretation. On the other hand, the experiments, again, let's say, if interpreted correctly, say very little about this particular problem, because both Abraham and Minkowski give you the same answer if you're careful about what you calculate. So how do we think about this? If you want to actually do some kind of momentum accounting, you've got a light pulse coming in here, or a photon coming in and leaving off of this mirror, and it's giving you this essentially 2N H bar K recoil because it's getting a kick and then a second kick from going out that way. But what happens is, again, if you calculate the Minkowski formula that I had up there at the beginning, at the interface here between the vacuum and the dielectric, there's a force on the dielectric that actually points outwards, and it's N minus 1 H bar K. And again, the same thing as you leave the bucket, there's a kick that again points outwards with N minus 1 H bar K. And if you add up these three forces, then the force on this system is 2 H bar K, which should be very, you know, very much a relief in the sense that I'm sending in a photon from a long distance away here and it's coming back out and I've got H bar K coming in and H bar K coming out, and so I better only leave 2 H bar K behind. But the difference is that I'm giving some of it to the dielectric and some of it to the mirror. And so if you want to think about this in terms of the Abraham picture, what you've got is a photon. Well, in the Minkowski picture is just what we talked about there. I've got a photon coming in with NH bar K, and it reflects off of this mirror, and it gives me 2NH bar K. In the Abraham picture, I've got these same outward forces on the bucket, but now I'm going to give this extra Abraham force term to a volume force on the dielectric. So propagating along with this pulse or photon is a momentum given to the dielectric of N minus 1 over N H bar K, and these things add up, and they also give you 2 H bar K in the far distant field. And what you find is that, of course, the mirror still has to, the observable was that the mirror is going to deflect proportional to N H bar K, but you're no longer just reflecting a photon off of that mirror. I've got a dielectric here that's in contact with the mirror, and I'm bouncing a piece of dielectric with momentum off of that mirror as well. And so the recoil, essentially, that the mirror gets is due to both the dielectric and the photon, and the field in this case. So again, you have to pay attention to both the field part of the tensor and the matter part in doing these kinds of calculations. So one of the things that comes up in this is then kind of an analogy to sound waves, where you say, you know, I mean, I don't quite understand why my photon doesn't have all the momentum and why my dielectric has some of it. But if you think about doing, say, an acousto-optic modulator or any sort of kind of acoustic thing, you can transfer acoustic energy or momentum in the piece of glass to a light beam by making a standing wave, acoustic wave in there and bouncing light off of it. But an acoustic wave propagates in this crystal and it doesn't actually carry any momentum. If you define momentum as mass times velocity, there's no mass transport. So typically what we do is we say, oh, well, that's quasi-momentum. It's not real momentum, but it's quasi-momentum, and we can transfer quasi-momentum to the photon if we want. So sound, being entirely material-based field, has only this pseudo-momentum. In the case of light in a dielectric, it's neither a completely material-based or matter-based entity. The polariton in the matter now, in the Abraham picture, has both momentum and pseudo-momentum in the medium. So all these kinds of experiments of kind of the mirror in the bucket don't actually address this Abraham Minkowski momentum controversy. It's a little different question. It's kind of asking, what is the momentum recoil of some absorber or reflector in the medium? And while an interesting question, it's not really the same question as what is the momentum carried by a photon in the medium. If by what you mean in that case is the photon is the purely field, electromagnetic field-based bit. So both Abraham and Minkowski camps would answer the first question the same, and I think this has been experimentally well established. but it's essentially the question of, is the recoil HBAR-K or NHBAR-K? And you'll recall that what we're trying to ask here is the recoil HBAR-K over N or NHBAR-K? Or not the recoil, but the photon momentum. So it's a little different question. So there's a series of these kind of mirror in a bucket things, questions of atom recoil in gases. A very recent experiment that was published just a couple of months ago by Ketterly's group, looking at atoms getting kicked in a Bose condensate, doing Bragg scattering in a Bose condensate, and some very very nice precision measurements showing the index of refraction there matters. There's things called photon drag detectors, and photon drag experiments can be looked at in the same way. Essentially, a semiconductor with light impinging on it. In some sense, there's this photon wind that blows the electrons back and produces a voltage across the sample. And so you can buy photon drag detectors in the far infrared, I believe. So these things can be interpreted in terms of this same sort of absorber reflector in a dielectric. And then similarly, atom recoil things from evanescent waves, where you're essentially looking at the field inside of a dielectric, but through total internal reflection, you're kind of bleeding some of it out and then letting atoms bounce off of it. And that gives you, you can measure the atom recoil there, and that's a very similar type of thing. All of these experiments give the same answer, and I would say establish the NHBAR-K versus HBAR-K recoil in a medium. But that N is the phase index. And so this is, I think, just what I said. It doesn't really deal with what we want to talk about in terms of this block of glass problem. So as far as I can tell, this is the only sort of experiment that really addresses the question of Abraham versus Minkowski in that sense. What is the photon momentum in the medium? You really have to look at what's going on inside the medium and not hitting something in the medium, but kind of what the undisturbed photon sees. There are a number, there are other proposals than this sort of block of glass thing that have to do with, say, a long fiber wrapped on a torsion balance and trying to do a force on this fiber. I think it's essentially the same spirit of this, but the analysis, I'm afraid I don't understand, so I won't talk about it. So again, the proposed experiment, how am I going to actually make this thing look at all like a block of glass and slow light and things like that? So I need an index of kind of 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 to get 10 microns of movement. And so I better be able to do that reasonably well. So there were some experiments done by Lena Howe's group about 5 years ago, showed that you can do kind of electromagnetically induced transparency, where you set up some coherent superposition of these ground states by putting in a control beam and then putting in your pulse along some other transition. And you can make this transparency window show up in your atomic vapor absorption. And it has a big dispersion that goes along with that absorption feature, or transmission feature in this case. And it's this big slope of the dispersion that gives you a large group velocity index. And so in this case, they saw 17 meters per second, and you probably saw all the articles that said, you know, slower than a bicycle light, things like that. That gives you a group index of 2 times 10 to the 7. So I'm actually being conservative when I'm doing 10 to the 6. Unfortunately, if you notice here, they got about 65% transmission, which is not really amazing. And I have a bit of a problem with that, which we'll come back to in a moment. Photon by photon, this is kind of why I really believe the Abraham interpretation. If you talk about your photons in terms of polaritons and doing these atomic transitions, Raman transitions in individual atoms, this all kind of hangs together very well. So if we convert photons in a vacuum to what we'll call polaritons in the medium, the photons move at a velocity c, and the polaritons, which are these coupled atom field entities, move at some velocity c divided by the group index. And I'm going to now put on my control beam that sits on this other transition at an orthogonal direction to my pulse of light that's coming through. And so this kind of allows me to say I've got this black box that I'm going to call a block of glass. And if my control beam is orthogonal to that, then if all I'm doing is looking at the momentum along this direction, I don't have to worry about that for the moment. So I can just do momentum accounting along the direction of this pulse and deal with that. And so I have an h-bar k kick as the atom essentially absorbs that photon, and I get an h-bar k in some other direction here, orthogonal to it now, due to the control beam. So each ground state atom will become this polariton by undergoing this Raman transition and get transferred essentially from state, the lower state here, to this one, and get this recoil from undergoing that transition. The real momentum that's associated with this depends on the angle between these two things. So if I go to very close small angles, I can get a small recoil. If I go orthogonal, it's root 2 h bar k. So I'll need this for producing EIT. Just to do kind of an atom by atom momentum accounting, you say, well, all right, I got 3 million atoms, and my microwatt pulse here was 3×10⁶ photons per microsecond, and it stays in there for a 0.3 microsecond transit time, gives you about 10⁶ polaritons in steady state. You don't want that number to be larger than the number of atoms, but probably this is too high a fraction. But at any rate, so a third of the atoms are turned into polaritons. For orthogonal beams, then each polariton carries one h bar k along the direction that I care about. And for sodium, the recoil velocity, which we all know is 3 cm/s, well, you have if you've worked with sodium for 10, 15 years. On average, a third of the atoms now are carrying this recoil velocity, so it's essentially 1 cm/s if the whole block is moving, the whole cloud is moving together. 1 cm/s times the one millisecond pulse duration gives me a 10 micron displacement, and it all agrees with my previous calculation. And I wouldn't have showed you if it didn't. So, Abraham versus Minkowski. I don't have a 10⁶ phase index. I have a 10⁶ group index. So, Abraham gives me, in fact, if you do this carefully, you get a displacement that's proportional to mng minus 1. Well, you know, who cares about the minus 1 when ng is 10⁶? But it's just the same formula with a group index in there. Minkowski, on the other hand, the answer changes a little bit. It's still got the minus sign that we had. If you recall before, this was minus n times the Abraham answer. Now it's minus n minus 1 times the Abraham answer, but this n is the phase index. So typically, for these types of slow light experiments, you have a group index of about 10⁶ and a phase index of maybe 1.001, because this is, after all, still, by anybody else's standard, a pretty good vacuum. So there's not much in the line of atoms there. The phase index is just barely different from 1, which makes this displacement really small. So 10⁻³ times 10 microns, I'm not going to see. But I can tell basically the difference between it moving 10 microns and it not moving. So that I should be able to measure. So, you don't want to hear about that. Residual absorption, again, this is a little bit of a problem. In the accounting that I've done, a microwatt, I need to get, you know, these 3 million photons per microsecond or 3 billion photons through my condensate, and I want some atoms left. So it means that I can afford less than 0.1% absorption. And this is perhaps a tough call. So this is probably the real make or break part of this experiment. If I can get EIT to work in this system at that level of transparency, then I think we can move forward. The BEC has a block of glass. What's important here is that the recoil that a atom in the condensate gets keeps it in the condensate, which is to say, if I take an individual atom and thwack it one, it better get hit with a recoil that's less than the velocity of sound in the medium. Otherwise, I'm going to be left with a jiggling mass, or worse yet, atoms ejected from the condensate, and I won't have anything left when I'm done. So for sodium under normal circumstances, the recoil needs to be about a tenth of an H bar K to not go and excite jiggling mass in my condensate. So then I have to bring my control beam down to some relatively small angle. This complicates the interpretation and makes this transparency requirement even more stringent. So for that, I can just go and take my last order of magnitude and get an index of 10 to the 7, right? So I was saving that. But at any rate, this gives me still a really tough transparency requirement. So there is one more way around this. If you know about Bose condensates, you can do a magnetic Feshbach resonance, make the scattering length really large, and make the velocity of sound in the condensate large enough that it can handle a whole H bar K recoil. And the unfortunate part of that is the first good magnetic Feshbach resonance for sodium is at about a kilogauss, which is not necessarily compatible with the rest of our apparatus. So if we actually have to do that, it becomes more of a problem. So can it be done? It's a big effect in the scheme of, I'm still hoping we can do it. But it's a qualitative rather than a quantitative experiment, and I think it does, at the very least, bring in the conversation again about Abraham versus Minkowski choices. And even if people are not absolutely, confirmed that there is no controversy, it allows them to once again say there is no controversy. The experiment also gives a graphic demonstration of faster-than-light effects. So if you imagine now I replaced my Bose condensate with a large positive index, I can use gain lines in there, change the slope of the dispersion, and do fast light experiments. And these types of experiments, again, have been done in atomic vapors. I haven't seen 10 to the 7 index, but nonetheless, one can hope to do that. And then it all seems a little weird because we've been arguing about how the photon changes to H bar K over N in there. And, well, N's got a different sign, and the block of glass is supposed to go in the other direction. And so, although some people, like Peter, seem to think this is, well, if not natural, at least it's absolutely the answer he expected, it is kind of an interesting thing. You can think about what this actually means in terms of metamaterials. If you've made, we're not going to do this with a Bose condensate, but if you've made a structured material that has a large dispersion that's dependent on diffraction effects in the material, you can still expect that the block of glass is going to go in the wrong direction. So it's just kind of an interesting thing, kind of fun thing to think about. And so what actually went wrong? Well, again, when I'm doing this, you can't really get away with saying P equal H bar K in the medium, just like when I assume that equal MC squared, I've assumed the Abraham answer. If I, you know, say P equal H bar K in the medium, this assumes that the photon carries all of the momentum and none of it is put into the matter, and so that gives you Minkowski answer because you've made some unfounded assumption here, and this gives you the Abraham answer because you've made some unfounded assumption there. The end. Thanks. Well, now, the question is what happens with a single atom? So, in fact, I gave this as a poster at a laser spectroscopy conference a couple years ago, and Victor Belekin walked up to me and said immediately, well, take a single atom. Of course it does this. What's the problem? Walked away. So this was, you know, this is one way of looking at it, that... Well, we know what happens with a single atom, and it's one of the nice things about atomic physics, right? Is we can talk about little ball physics here and say I've got a recoil, and on the other hand, the whole Abraham Minkowski thing is phenomenological electrodynamics. Do you really want to give your atom an index of refraction? It's not a really well-defined concept. I mean, if you read Peter's book, it says that unless you have enough atoms within a wavelength range, you can't really define the index of refraction properties, the analytic properties or whatever, well enough to really call it an index of refraction. So that's my cop out on this: is that yes, I claim you get the same answer with a simple single particle, but or single atom, but it's just not interesting.
Other questions? Say, at the beginning, you proposed three different cases, and then one you said it is not the interesting one, where
yeah,
happened.
Right.
But then in the experiment where, so you have one case where it goes by 10 microns a year, hypothesis it doesn't move.
Well, okay. It doesn't move observably, right? It moves it moves backwards by a hundredth of a micron, which... Yeah, I mean, in some sense, this has been... In fact, I think Ginsburg, in a number of places, has made the observation of, well, this is not of engineering of importance, so it doesn't matter which one you use. Yeah, it's kind of just intellectually not a warm, fuzzy feeling. You want something that kind of more metaphysically you can understand what's going on. And yeah, I mean, it doesn't necessarily distinguish between those, but I don't think there are many people who are adamantly claiming that absolutely nothing happens, that it seems to be falling down into the Abraham or Minkowski, and if I can see the difference between those two, I'm happy enough to restart the old controversy.
Other questions? So I still have one, actually, about this problem of the transparency.
Mm-hmm.
You started with an assumption of a particular number of atoms and a particular group index that you needed, and then you needed this 0.1% transparency. How does the trade-off really work? Does it not just make sense to change the number of photons in the pulse and compensate for that with the group index? Is this really the best you can do?
Well, it's kind of, yeah, it's a matter of, you know, what's the mass of your pulse of light compared to the mass of your block of glass, or the effective mass of the pulse of light with the index in there. So you can kind of sort of win in some ways. the thing that I kind of started with was, let's start with a condensate that I know I can make. And there are a whole, I've swept all the details under the rug, of course, which you're not supposed to bring up. But there are these things of what happens, say, near the edge of the condensate. The density determines the velocity of sound in the condensate. The density isn't constant. I could go to smaller numbers of atoms, but I need to keep the density the same to keep the recoil the same. There are also questions of, as we talked about earlier, I have a block of glass here that I've assumed to be perfectly rigid, which means that my pulse comes in and exerts a force on the front surface, and the back surface has to start to move, which violates causality and all kinds of other things. So you actually have to worry about the compressibility of this thing as well. And so you've got all kinds of friction forces that you want to make sure don't excite all kinds of oscillations in your condensate. And these are trade-offs that may be able to be made a little bit if I can go to smaller condensates and fewer photons or something like that. But for the most part, this kind of seems to be conserved, and I'm not sure what I get to trade off until I do a little bit more detailed modeling of these things. Well, in the sense that in this case, we're talking about light that's near essentially a transition of the outer electron to a higher state. If you rip that electron off, then you've charged the system, and it's going to all fly apart due to Coulomb repulsion. Practically speaking, that makes it very difficult. Basically, all it does is it really distorts what the optical transitions are that you have to deal with. Sodium has one extra floating around, one kind of valence electron floating around the edge. So everything else is a closed shell, so we're just taking the one that's outside the closed shell. And, yeah. Nothing that I'm aware of that really addresses this. The only things that I've seen that kind of deal with liquid stuff is these kind of mirror in a bucket experiments. And if you're talking about something like Ketterly's experiment where he's kicking atoms and looking at the recoil in there, I haven't seen anything in liquids. It's something that I think the Ashkin paper claims that addresses this question of what's the surface force there. And then, I don't know, a year or two later, Gordon wrote a paper saying, well, no, actually, that has nothing to do with it. What you've got is this beam of light in the dielectric, and there are all these dipole forces that are basically pulling the dielectric into the beam of light and kind of squeezing up the surface. So it's not really a surface force that you're really measuring there. You're pulling the dielectric into the high intensity of the light. So in the same way, say, an optical tweezers works to grab little pieces of dielectric, it's kind of squeezing in more of the fluid, and that's what's producing the bulge, and that dominates the whole thing. So that's kind of the problem here, is that you almost, well, you have to try and do it with an infinite plane wave of light, and then you don't really get to do that. So
I just think it's exciting to hear that we can still do optics experiments, or even after doing the experiment, we're not sure what the experiment is about.
Right.
I'd like you all to help me in thanking one more time both of the speakers who were kind enough to come and participate in this, Peter Maloney and Paul Lett, and also Maria Wong, who did a lot of the organization and was really indispensable to getting this thing to run as smoothly as it could, given flight problems.